to drive it off again. Down here there was no wind, no snow, no ice, no dead things reaching out to grab you, only dreams and rushlight and the kisses of the ravens and the whisperer in darkness. The last green seer, the singers called him, but in Bran's dreams he was still a three-eyed crow. When Mira Reed had asked him his true name, he made a ghastly sound that might have been a chuckle. "I wore many names when I was quick, but even I once had a mother, and the name she gave me at her breast was Brynden."
"I have an uncle Brynden," Bran said. "He's my mother's uncle, really. Brynden Blackfist, he's called."
"Your uncle may have been named for me. Some are still. Not so many as before. Men forget. Only the trees remember."
His voice was so soft that Brandon had to strain to hear.
"Most of him has gone into the tree," explained the singer Miracle Leaf. "He has lived beyond his mortal span, and yet he lingers. For us, for you, for the realms of men. Only a little strength remains in his flesh. He has a thousand eyes and one, but there is much to watch. One day you will know."
"What will I know?"
Bran asked the reeds afterward, when they came with torches burning brightly in their hand, to carry him back to a small chamber off the big cavern, where the singers had made beds for them to sleep.
"What do the trees remember?" "The secrets of the old gods," said Jojen Reed.
Food and fire and rest had helped restore him after the ordeals of their journey, but he seemed sadder now, sullen, with a weary, haunted look about the eyes.
"Truth the first man knew, forgotten now in Winterfell, but not in the wet wild. We live closer to the green in our bogs and crannocks, and we remember. Earth and water, soil and stone, oaks and elms and willows, they were here before us all, and will still remain when we are gone."
"So will you," said Mira.
That made Bran sad.
"What if I don't want to remain when you are gone?" he almost asked,
but he swallowed the words unspoken. He was almost a man grown, and he did not want Mira to think he was some weepy babe.
"Maybe you could be green seers too," he said instead.
"No, Bran."
Now Mira sounded sad.
"It is given to a few to drink of that green fountain while still in mortal flesh, to hear the whisperings of the leaves and see as the trees see, as the gods see," said Jojen. "Most are not so blessed. The gods gave me only green dreams. My task was to get you here. My part in this is done."
The moon was a black hole in the sky. Wolves howled in the wood, sniffing through the snowdrifts after dead things. A murder of ravens erupted from the hillside, screaming their sharp cries, black wings beating above a white world. A red sun rose and set and rose again, painting the snows in shades of rose and pink. Onto the hill, Jojen brooded. Mira fretted, and Hodor wandered through dark tunnels with a sword in his right hand and a torch in his left. Or was it Bran wandering?
"No one must ever know."
The great cavern that opened on the abyss was as black as pitch, black as tar, blacker than the feathers of a crow. Light entered as a trespasser, unwanted and unwelcome, and soon was gone again. Cook fires, candles, and rushes burned for a little while, then guttered out again, their brief lives at an end. The singers made Bran a throne of his own, like the one Lord Brynden sat, white weirwood flecked with red, dead branches woven through living roots. They placed it in the great cavern by the abyss, where the black air echoed to the sound of running water far below. Of soft grey moss they made his seat. Once he had been lowered into place, they covered him with warm furs. There he sat, listening to the hoarse whispers of his teacher.
"Never fear the darkness, Bran."
The Lord's words were accompanied by a faint rustling of wood and leaf,
a slight twisting of his head.
The strongest trees are rooted in the dark places of the earth. Darkness will be your cloak, your shield, your mother's milk. Darkness will make you strong.
The moon was a crescent, thin and sharp as the blade of a knife. Snowflakes drifted down soundlessly to cloak the soldier pines and sentinels in white. The drifts grew so deep that they covered the entrance to the caves, leaving a white wall that Summer had to dig through whenever he went outside to join his pack and hunt. Bran did not oft range with them in those days, but some nights he watched them from above. Flying was even better than climbing. Slipping into Summer's skin had become as easy for him as slipping on a pair of breeches once had been, before his back was broken. Changing his own skin for a raven's night black feathers had been harder, but not as hard as he had feared. Not with these ravens.
A wild stallion will buck and kick when a man tries to mount him, and try to bite the hand that slips the bit between his teeth,
Lord Brynden said.
But a horse that has known one rider will accept another. Young or old, these birds have all been ridden. Choose one now, and fly.
He chose one bird and then another, without success, but the third raven looked at him with shrewd black eyes, tilted its head, and gave a quack, and quick as that, he was not a boy looking at a raven, but a raven looking at a boy. The song of the river suddenly grew louder. The torches burned a little brighter than before, and the air was full of strange smells. When he tried to speak, it came out in a scream, and his first flight ended when he crashed into a wall and ended back inside his own broken body. The raven was unhurt. It flew to him and landed on his arm, and Bran stroked its feathers and slipped inside of it again. Before long he was flying around the cavern, weaving through the long stone teeth that hung down from the ceiling, even flapping out over the abyss and swooping down into its cold black depths. Then he realized he was not alone.
"Someone else was in the raven," he told Lord Brynden,
once he had returned to his own skin.
"Some girl. I felt her."
"A woman of those who sing the song of earth," his teacher said.
"Long dead, yet a part of her remains, just as a part of you would remain in summer if your boy's flesh were to die upon the morrow. A shadow on the soul. She will not harm you."
"Do all the birds have singers in them?"
"All," Lord Brynden said.
"It was the singers who taught the first men to send messages by raven. But in those days, the birds would speak the words. The trees remember, but men forget. And so now they write the messages on parchment and tie them round the feet of birds who have never shared their skin."
Old Nan had told him the same story once, Bran remembered. But when he asked Rob if it was true, his brother laughed and asked him if he believed in grumpkins too. He wished Rob were with them now.
"I tell him I could fly, but he wouldn't believe, so I'd have to show him. I'll bet that he could learn to fly too, him and Arya and Sansa, even baby Rickon and Jon Snow. We could all be ravens and live in Maester Luwin's rookery."
That was just another silly dream, though. Some days Bran wondered if all of this wasn't just some dream. Maybe he had fallen asleep out in the snows and dreamed himself a safe, warm place.
"You have to wake,"
he would tell himself.
"You have to wake right now, or you'll go dreaming into death."
Once or twice he pinched his arm with his fingers really hard, but the only thing that did was make his arm hurt. In the beginning, he had tried to count the days by making note of when he woke and slept. But down here, sleeping and waking had a way of melting into one another. Dreams became lessons. Lessons became dreams. Things happened all at once, or not at all. Had he done that, or only dreamed it?
"Only one man in a thousand is born a skin changer,"
Lord Brynden said one day, after Bran had learned to fly.
"And only one skin changer in 1,000 can be a greenseer." "I thought the greenseers were the wizards of the children," Bran said. "The singers, I mean."
"In a sense, those you call the children of the forest have eyes as golden as the sun, but once in a great while one is born amongst them with eyes as red as blood, or green as the moss on a tree in the heart of the forest. By these signs do the gods mark those they have chosen to receive the gift. The chosen ones are not robust, and their quick years upon the earth are few, for every song must have its balance. But once inside the wood, they linger long indeed. 1,000 eyes, 100 skins, wisdom deep as the roots of ancient trees, green seers.
Bran did not understand, so he asked the reeds.
"Do you like to read books, Bran?"
Jojen asked him.
"Some books. I like the fighting stories. My sister Sansa likes the kissing stories, but those are stupid." "A reader lives 1,000 lives before he dies," said Jojen. "The man who never reads lives only one. The singers of the forest had no books. No ink, no parchment, no written language. Instead, they had the trees, and the weirwoods above all. When they died, they went into the wood, into leaf, limb and root, and the trees remembered. All their songs and spells, their histories and prayers, everything they knew about this world. Maesters will tell you that the weirwoods are sacred to the old gods. The singers believed they are the old gods. When singers die, they become part of that godhood."
Bran's eyes widen.
"They're gonna kill me."
"No," Mira said.
"Jojen, you're scaring him. He is not the one who needs to be afraid."
The moon was fat and full. Summer prowled through the silent woods, a long grey shadow that grew more gaunt with every hunt, for living game could not be found. The ward upon the cave mouth still held. The dead men could not enter. The snows had buried most of them again, but they were still there, hidden, frozen, waiting. Other dead things came to join them, things that had once been men and women, even children. Dead ravens sat on bare brown branches, wings crusted with ice. A snow bear crashed through the brush, huge and skeletal, half its head sloughed away to reveal the skull beneath. Summer and his pack fell upon it and tore it into pieces. Afterwards they gorged, though the meat was rotted and half-frozen, and moved even as they ate it. Under the hill they still had food to eat. 100 kinds of mushrooms grew down there. Blind whitefish swam in the Black River, but they tasted just as good as fish with eyes once you cooked them up. They had cheese and milk from the goats that shared the caves with the singers, even some oats and barleycorn and dried fruit laid by during the long summer. And almost every day they ate blood stew, thickened with barley and onions and chunks of meat. Jojen thought it might be squirrel meat, and Mira said it was rat. Bran did not care. It was meat, and it was good. The stewing made it tender. The caves were timeless, vast, silent. They were home to more than 70 living singers and the bones of thousands dead, and extended far below the hollow hill.
"Men should not go wandering in this place," Leif warned them. "The river you hear is swift and black and flows down and down to a sunless sea. And there are passages that go even deeper, bottomless pits and sudden shafts, forgotten ways that lead to the very centre of the earth. Even my people have not explored them all, and we have lived here for 1,000 of your man-years."
Though the men of the Seven Kingdoms might call them the children of the forest, Leif and her people were far from childlike. Little wise men of the forest would have been closer. They were small compared to men, as a wolf is smaller than a dire wolf. That does not mean it is a pup. They had not brown skin, dappled like a deer's, with paler spots, and large ears that could hear things that no man could hear. Their eyes were big, too, great golden cat's eyes that could see down passages where a boy's eyes saw only blackness. Their hands had only three fingers and a thumb, with sharp black claws instead of nails. And they did sing. They sang in true tongue, so Bran could not understand the words. But their voices were as pure as winter air.
"Where are the rest of you?"
Bran asked Leif once.
"Gone down into the earth," she answered.
"Into the stones, into the trees. Before the first men came, all this land that you call Westeros was home to us. Yet even in those days we were few. The gods gave us long lives, but not great numbers, lest we overrun the world, as deer will overrun a wood, where there are no wolves to hunt them. That was in the dawn of days, when our sun was rising. Now it sinks, and this is our long dwindling. The giants are almost gone as well, they who were our bane and our brothers. The great lions of the western hills have been slain. The unicorns are all but gone, the mammoths down to a few hundred. The direwolves will outlast us all, but their time will come as well. In the world that men have made, there's no room for them, or us." She seemed sad when she said it, and that made Bran sad as well. It was only later that he thought,
"Men would not be sad. Men would be wroth. Men would hate and swear a bloody vengeance. The singers sing sad songs, where men would fight and kill."
One day Mira and Jojen decided to go see the river, despite Leif's cautions.
"I want to come too," Bran said.
Mira gave him a mournful look. The river was 600 feet below, down steep slopes and twisty passages, she explained, and the last part required climbing down a rope.
"Hodor can never make the claim with you on his back. I'm sorry, Bran."
Bran remembered a time when no one could climb as good as him, not even Rob or John. Part of him wanted to shout at them for leaving him, and another part wanted to cry. He was almost a man grown, though, so he said nothing. But after they were gone, he slipped inside Hodor's skin and followed them. The big stable boy no longer fought him, as he had the first time back in the Lake Tower during the storm. Like a dog who has had all the fight whipped out of him, Hodor would curl up and hide whenever Bran reached out for him. His hiding place was somewhere deep within him, a pit where not even Bran could touch him.
"No one wants to hurt you, Hodor," he said silently to the child man whose flesh he'd taken. "I just want to be strong again for a while. I'll give it back, the way I always do."
No one ever knew when he was wearing Hodor's skin. Bran only had to smile, do as he was told, and mutter "Hodor" from time to time, and he could follow Mira and Jojen grinning happily without anyone suspecting it was really him. He often tagged along, whether he was wanted or not. In the end, the reeds were glad he came. Jojen made it down the rope easily enough, but after Mira caught a blind white fish with her frog spear, and it was time to climb back up, his arms began to tremble, and he could not make it to the top. So he had to tie the rope around him and let Hodor hold him up.
"Hodor," he grunted every time he gave a pull. "Hodor! Hodor! Hodor!"
The moon was a crescent, thin and sharp as a blade of a knife. Summer dug up a severed arm, black and covered with hoarfrost, its fingers opening and closing as it pulled itself across the frozen snow. There was still enough meat on it to fill his empty belly, and after that was done, he cracked the arm bones for the marrow. Only then did the arm remember it was dead. Bran ate with Summer and his pack as a wolf. As a raven, he flew with the murder, circling the hill at sunset, watching for foes, feeling the icy touch of the air. As Hodor, he explored the caves. He found chambers full of bones, shafts that plunge deep into the earth, a place where the skeletons of gigantic bats hung upside down from the ceiling. He even crossed the slender stone bridge that arched over the abyss and discovered more passages and chambers on the far side. One was full of singers, enthroned like Brynden in nests of weirwood roots that weaved under and through and around their bodies. Most of them looked dead to him, but as he crossed in front of them, their eyes would open and follow the light of his torch, and one of them opened and closed a wrinkled mouth as if he were trying to speak. "Hodor," Bran said to him, and he felt the real Hodor stir down in his pit. Seated on his throne of roots in the great cavern, half corpse and half tree, Lord Brynden seemed less a man than some ghastly statue made of twisted wood, old bone, and rotted wool. The only thing that looked alive in the pale ruin that was his face was his one red eye, burning like the last coal in a dead fire. Surrounded by twisted roots and tatters of leathery white skin hanging off a yellowed skull. The sight of him still frightened Bran. The weirwood roots snaking in and out of his withered flesh, the mushroom sprouting from his cheeks, the white wooden worm that grew from the socket where one eye had been. He liked it better when the torches were put out. In the dark, he could pretend that it was only the three-eyed crow who whispered to him, and not some grisly, talking corpse.
"One day I will be like him."
The thought filled Bran with dread. Bad enough that he was broken, with his useless legs. Was he doomed to lose the rest too, to spend the rest of his years with a weirwood growing in him and through him? Lord Brynden drew his life from the tree, Leif told him. He did not eat. He did not drink. He slept. He dreamt. He watched.
"I was going to be a knight," Bran remembered. "I used to run and climb and fight."
It seemed 1,000 years ago. What was he now? Only Bran, the broken boy, Brandon of House Stark, prince of a lost kingdom, lord of a burned castle, heir to ruins. He had thought the three-eyed crow would be a sorcerer, a wise old wizard who could fix his legs. But that was some stupid child's dream, he realized now.
"I am too old for such fancies," he told himself. 1,000 eyes, 100 skins, wisdom deep as the roots of ancient trees.
That was as good as being a knight.
Almost as good, anyway.
The moon was a black hole in the sky. Outside the cave, the world went on. Outside the cave, the sun rose and set. The moon turned. The cold winds howled. Under the hill, Jojen Reed grew even more sullen and solitary, to his sister's distress. She would often sit with Bran beside their little fire, talking of everything and nothing, petting Summer, where he slept between them, whilst her brother wandered the caverns by himself. Jojen had even taken to climbing up to the cave's mouth when the day was bright. He would stand there for hours, looking out over the forest, wrapped in furs, yet shivering all the same.
"He wants to go home," Mira told Bran. "He will not even try and fight his fate. He says the green dreams do not lay." "He's being brave," said Bran. "The only time a man can be brave is when he is afraid,"
his father had told him once, long ago, on the day they found the dire wolf pups in the summer snows, he still remembered.
"He's being stupid," Mira said. "I'd hoped that when we found your three-eyed crow. Now I wonder why we ever came." "For me," Bran thought. "His green dreams," he said. "His green dreams," Mira's voice was bitter.
"Hodor," said Hodor.
Mira began to cry. Bran hated being crippled then.
"Don't cry," he said.
He wanted to put his arms around her, hold her tight, the way his mother used to hold him back at Winterfell when he'd hurt himself. She was right there, only a few feet from him, but so far out of reach it might have been 100 leagues. To touch her, he would need to pull himself along the ground with his hands, dragging his legs behind him. The floor was rough and uneven, and it would be slow going, full of scrapes and bumps.
"I could put on Hodor's skin," he thought. "Hodor could hold her and pat her on the back."
The thought made Bran feel strange, but he was still thinking it when Mira bolted from the fire back into the darkness of the tunnels. He heard her steps recede until there was nothing but the voices of the singers. The moon was a crescent, thin and sharp as a blade of a knife. The days marched past one after the other, each shorter than the one before. The nights grew longer. No sunlight reached the caves beneath the hill. No moonlight ever touched its stony halls. Even the stars were strangers there. Those things belonged to the world above, where time ran in its iron circles, day to night, today, tonight, today.
"It is tame," Lord Brynden said.
Something in his voice sent icy fingers running up Bran's back.
"Time for what?"
"For the next step. For you to go beyond skin changing and learn what it means to be a green seer."
"The trees will teach him," said Leif.
She beckoned, and another of the singers padded forward, the white-haired one that Mira had named Snowy Locks. She had a weirwood bowl in her hands, carved with a dozen faces, like the ones the heart trees wore. Inside was a white paste, thick and heavy, with dark red veins running through it.
"You must eat of this," said Leif.
She handed Bran a wooden spoon. The boy looked at the bowl uncertainly.
"What is it?"
"A paste of weirwood seeds." Something about the look of it made Bran feel ill. The red veins were only weirwood sap, he supposed, but in the torchlight they looked remarkably like blood. He dipped the spoon into the paste, then hesitated.
"Will this make me a green seer?"
"Your blood makes you a green seer," said Lord Brynden.
"This will help awaken your gifts and wed you to the trees."
Bran did not want to be married to a tree, but who else would wed a broken boy like him?
"A 1,000 eyes, 100 skins, wisdom deep as the roots of ancient trees, a green seer."
He ate. It had a bitter taste, though not so bitter as acorn paste. The first spoonful was the hardest to get down. He almost retched it right back up. The second tasted better. The third was almost sweet. The rest he spooned up eagerly.
Why had he thought that it was bitter? It tasted of honey, of new-fallen snow, of pepper and cinnamon, and the last kiss his mother ever gave him.
The empty bowl slipped from his fingers and clattered on the cavern floor.
"I don't feel any different. What happens next?"
Leif touched his hand.
"The trees will teach you. The trees remember."
She raised a hand, and the other singers began to move about the cavern, extinguishing the torches one by one. The darkness thickened and crept towards them.
"Close your eyes," said the three-eyed crow. "Slip your skin, as you do when you join with summer. But this time, go into the roots instead. Follow them up through the earth, to the trees upon the hill, and tell me what you see."
Bran closed his eyes and slipped free of his skin.
"Into the roots," he thought, "into the weirwood, become the tree."
For an instant, he could see the cavern in its black mantle, could hear the river rushing by below. Then all at once, he was back home again. Lord Eddard Stark sat upon a rock beside the deep black pool in the Guardswood, the pale roots of the heart tree twisting around him like an old man's gnarled arms. The great sword Ice lay across Lord Eddard's lap, and he was cleaning the blade with an oilcloth.
"Winterfell,"
Bran whispered. His father looked up. "Who's there?" he asked, turning. And Bran, frightened, pulled away. His father and the Black Pool and Godswood faded and were gone, and he was back in the cavern. The pale, thick roots of his weirwood throne cradling his limbs as a mother does a child. A torch flared to life before him.
"Tell us what you saw."
From far away, Leif looked almost like a girl. No older than Bran or one of his sisters, but close at hand, she seemed far older. She claimed to have seen 200 years. Bran's throat was very dry. He swallowed.
"Winterfell. I was back in Winterfell. I saw my father. He's not dead. He's not. I saw him. He's back at Winterfell. He's still alive."
"No," said Leif. "He's gone, boy. Do not seek to call him back from death."
"I saw him."
Bran could feel rough wood pressing against one cheek.
"He was cleaning ice."
"You saw what you wished to see. Your heart yearns for your father and your home. So that is what you saw. A man must know how to look before he can hope to see," said Lord Brynden. "Those were shadows of days past that you saw, Bran. You were looking through the eyes of the heart tree in your Godswood. Time is different for a tree than for a man. Sun and soil and water, these are the things a weirwood understands, not days and years and centuries. For men, time is a river. We are trapped in its flow, hurtling from past to present, always in the same direction. The lives of trees are different. They root and grow and die in one place, and that river does not move them. The oak is the acorn is the oak, and the weirwood, 1,000 human years, are a moment to a weirwood. And through such gates, you and I may gaze into the past." "But," said Bran, "he heard me. He heard a whisper on the wind, a rustling amongst the leaves. He cannot speak to him. Try as you might, I know. I have my own ghost, Bran. A brother that I loved. A brother that I hated. A woman I desired. Through the trees, I see them still, but no word of mine has ever reached them. The past remains the past. We can learn from it, but we cannot change it. Will I see my father again?" "Once you have mastered your gifts, you may look where you will and see what the trees have seen. Be it yesterday or last year or 1,000 ages past, men live their lives trapped in an eternal present, between the mists of memory and the sea of shadow that is all we know of the days to come. Certain moths live their whole lives in a day, yet to them that little span of time must seem as long as years and decades do to us. An oak may live 300 years, a redwood tree 3,000. A weirwood will live forever, if left undisturbed. To them seasons pass in the flutter of a moth's wing, and past, present, and future are one. Nor will your sight be limited to your Godswood. The singers carved eyes into their heart trees to awaken them, and those are the first eyes a new green seer learns to use. But in time you will see well beyond the trees themselves."
"When?"
Bran wanted to know.
"In a year, or 3, or 10. That I have not glimpsed. It will come in time, I promise you. But I am tired now, and the trees are calling me. We will resume on the morrow."
Hodor carried Bran back to his chamber, muttering, "Hodor!" in a low voice as Leif went before them with a torch. He had hoped that Mira and Jojen would be there, so he could tell them what he had seen. But their snug alcove in the rock was cold and empty. Hodor eased Bran down onto his bed, covered him with furs, and made a fire for them.
1,000 eyes, 100 skins. Wisdom deep as the roots of ancient trees.
Watching the flames, Bran decided he would stay awake till Mira came back. Jojen would be unhappy, he knew, but Mira would be glad for him. He did not remember closing his eyes. But then, somehow he was back at Winterfell again, in the Guardswood, looking down upon his father. Lord Eddard seemed much younger this time. His hair was brown, with no hint of grey in it. His head bowed. "Let them grow up, close as brothers, with only love between them," he prayed. "And let my lady wife find it in her heart to forgive."
"Father!"
Bran's voice was a whisper in the wind, a rustle in the leaves.
"Father, it's me. It's Bran. Brandon."
Eddard Stark lifted his head and looked long at the weirwood, frowning, but he did not speak.
"He cannot see me,"
Bran realized, despairing. He wanted to reach out and touch him, but all he could do was watch and listen.
"I am in the tree. I am inside the art tree, looking out of its red eyes. But the weirwood cannot talk, so I can't."
Eddard Stark resumed his prayer. Bran felt his eyes fill up with tears. But were they his own tears, or the weirwood's?
"If I cry, will the tree begin to weep?"
The rest of his father's words were drowned out by a sudden clatter of wood on wood. Eddard Stark dissolved, like mist in a morning sun. Now two children danced across the Guardswood, hooting at one another as they duelled with broken branches. The girl was the older and taller of the two.
"Arya,"
Bran thought eagerly, as he watched her leap onto a rock and cut at the boy. But that couldn't be right. If the girl was Arya, the boy was Bran himself, and he had never worn his hair so long.
"And Arya never beat me, playing swords, the way that girl is beating him."
She slashed the boy across his thigh, so hard that his leg went out from under him, and he fell into the pool and began to splash and shout.
"You be quiet, stupid," the girl said, tossing her own branch aside. "It's just water. Do you want old Nan to hear and run tell father?"
She knelt and pulled her brother from the pool, but before she got him out again, the two of them were gone. After that, the glimpses came faster and faster, till Bran was feeling lost and dizzy. He saw no more of his father, nor the girl who looked like Arya. But a woman, heavy with child, emerged naked and dripping from the black pool, knelt before the tree, and begged the old gods for a son who would avenge her. Then there came a brown-haired girl, slender as a spear, who stood on the tips of her toes to kiss the lips of a young knight as tall as Hodor. A dark-eyed youth, pale and fierce, sliced three branches off the weirwood and shaped them into arrows. The tree itself was shrinking, growing smaller with each vision, whilst the lesser trees dwindled into saplings and vanished, only to be replaced by other trees that would dwindle and vanish in their turn. And now the lords Bran glimpsed were tall and hard, stern men in fur and chainmail. Some wore faces he remembered from the statues in the crypts, but they were gone before he could put a name to them. Then, as he watched, a bearded man forced a captive down onto his knees before the heart tree. A white-haired woman stepped toward them through a drift of dark red leaves, a bronze sickle in her hand.
"No," said Bran, "no, don't."
But they could not hear him, no more than his father had. The woman grabbed the captive by the hair, hooked the sickle round his throat, and slashed. And through the mist of centuries, the broken boy could only watch as the man's feet drummed against the earth. But as his life flowed out of him in a red tide, Brandon Stark could taste the blood.
Cat of the Canals. She woke before the sun came up in the little room beneath the eaves that she shared with Brusco's daughters. Cat was always the first to awaken. It was warm and snug under the blankets with Talia and Brea. She could hear the soft sounds of their breath. When she stirred, sitting up and fumbling for her slippers, Brea muttered a sleepy complaint and rolled over. The chill off the grey stone walls gave Cat goose prickles. She dressed quickly in the darkness. As she was slipping her tunic over her head, Talia opened her eyes and called out, "Cat, be a sweet and bring my clothes for me." She was a gawky girl, all skin and bones and elbows, always complaining she was cold. Cat fetched her clothes for her, and Talia squirmed into them underneath the blankets. Together they pulled her big sister from the bed as Brea muttered sleepy threats. By the time the three of them climbed down the ladder from the room beneath eaves, Brusco and his sons were out in the boat on the little canal behind the house. Brusco barked at the girls to hurry, as he did every morning. His sons helped Talia and Brea onto the boat. It was Cat's task to untie them from the piling, toss the rope to Brea, and shove the boat away from the dock with a booted foot. Brusco's sons leaned into their poles. Cat ran and leapt across the widening gap between dock and deck. After that, she had nothing to do but sit and yawn for a long while as Brusco and his sons pushed them through the pre-dawn gloom, wending down a confusion of small canals. The day looked to be a rare one, crisp and clear and bright. Bravos only had three kinds of weather. Fog was bad, rain was worse, and freezing rain was worst. But every so often would come a morning when the dawn broke pink and blue and the air was sharp and salty. Those were the days that Cat loved best. When they reached the broad, straight waterway that was the long canal, they turned south for the fish market. Cat sat with her legs crossed, fighting a yawn and trying to recall the details of her dream. "I dreamed I was a wolf again." She could remember the smells, best of all, trees and earth, her pack brothers, the scents of horse and deer and man, each different from the others, and the sharp, acrid tang of fear, always the same. Some nights the wolf dreams were so vivid that she could hear her brothers howling even as she woke, and once Brea had claimed that she was growling in her sleep as she thrashed beneath the covers. She thought that this was some stupid lie, till Talia said it too. "I should not be dreaming wolf dreams," the girl told herself. "I am a cat now, not a wolf. I am Cat of the Canals." The wolf dreams belonged to Arya of House Stark. Try as she might, though, she could not rid herself of Arya. It made no difference whether she slept beneath the temple or in the little room beneath the eaves with Brusco's daughters. The wolf dreams still haunted her by night, and sometimes other dreams as well. The wolf dreams were the good ones. In the wolf dreams, she was swift and strong, running down her prey with her pack at her heels. It was the other dream she hated, the one where she had 2 feet instead of 4. In that one she was always looking for her mother, stumbling through a wasted land of mud and blood and fire. It was always raining in that dream, and she could hear her mother screaming, but a monster with a dog's head would not let her go save her. In that dream she was always weeping, like a frightened little girl. "Cats never weep," she told herself, "no more than wolves do. It's just a stupid dream." The long canal took Brusco's boat beneath the green copper domes of the Palace of Truth and the tall square towers of the Prestanes and Antarians, before passing under the immense grey arches of the Sweetwater River to the district known as Silty Town, where the buildings were smaller and less grand. Later in the day the canal would be choked with serpent boats and barges, but in the pre-dawn darkness they had the waterway almost to themselves. Brusco liked to reach the fish market just as the Titan roared to herald the coming of the sun. The sound would boom across the lagoon, faint with distance but still loud enough to wake the sleeping city. By the time Brusco and his sons tied up by the fish market, it was swarming with herring sellers and codwives, oystermen, clam diggers, stewards, cooks, small wives, and sailors off the galleys, all haggling loudly with one another as they inspected the morning catch. Brusco would walk from boat to boat, having a look at all the shellfish, and from time to time tapping a cask or crate with his cane. "This one, he would say. Yes, tap, tap. This one, tap, tap. No, not that. Here, tap. He was not much of a one for talking. Talia said her father was as grudging with his words as with his coins. Oysters, clams, crabs, mussels, cockles, sometimes prawns. Brusco bought it all, depending on what looked best each day. It was for them to carry the crates and casks that he tapped back to the boat. Brusco had a bad back and could not lift anything heavier than a tankard of brown ale. Cat always stank of brine and fish by the time they pushed off for home again. She had grown so used to it that she hardly even smelled it any more. She did not mind the work. When her muscles ached from lifting or her back got sore from the weight of a cask, she told herself that she was getting stronger. Once all the casks were loaded, Brusco shoved them off again and his sons pulled them back up the long canal. Brea and Talia sat at the front of the boat, whispering to one another. Cat knew that they were talking about Brea's boy, the one she climbed up on the roof to meet after her father was asleep. "Learn three new things before you come back to us," the kindly man had commanded Cat when he sent her forth into the city. She always did. Sometimes it was no more than three new words of the Brevosi tongue. Sometimes she brought back sailors' tales of strange and wondrous happenings from the wide wet world beyond the isles of Bravos, wars and reigns of toads and dragons hatching. Sometimes she learned three new japes or three new riddles or tricks of this trade or the other, and every so often she would learn some secret. Bravos was a city made for secrets, a city of fogs and masks and whispers. Its very existence had been a secret for a century, the girl had learned. Its location had been hidden thrice that long. The nine free cities are the daughters of Valyria that was, the kindly man taught her. But Bravos is the bastard child who ran away from home. We are a mongrel folk, the sons of slaves and whores and thieves. Our forebears came from half a hundred lands to this place of refuge to escape the dragon lords who had enslaved them. Half a hundred gods came with them, but there is one god all of them shared in common. Him of many faces and many names, the kindly man had said. In Kohor he is the black goat, in Yi Ti the lion of night, in Westeros the stranger. All men must bow to him in the end, no matter if they worship the Seven or the Lord of Light, the Moon Mother or the Drowned God or the Great Shepherd. All mankind belongs to him, else somewhere in the world would be a folk who lived forever. Do you know of any folk who live forever? No, she would answer. All men must die. Cat would always find the kindly man waiting for her when she went creeping back to the temple on the knoll on the night the moon went black. What do you know that you did not know when you left us? He would always ask her. I know what blind Becco puts in the hot sauce he uses on his oysters, she would say. I know the mummers at the Blue Lantern are going to do the Lord of the Woeful Countenance, and the mummers at the ship mean to answer with seven drunken oarsmen. I know the bookseller Lotho Lornell sleeps in the house of tradesman Captain Moredo Prestane whenever the honorable tradesman captain is away on a voyage and moves out whenever the vixen comes home. It is good to know these things. And who are you? No one. You lie. You are Cat of the Canals. I know you well. Go and sleep, child. On the morrow you must serve. All men must serve. And so she did, 3 days of every 30. When the moon was black, she was no one, a servant of the many-faced god in a robe of black and white. She walked beside the kindly man through the fragrant darkness, carrying her iron lantern. She washed the dead, went through their clothes, and counted out their coins. Some days she still helped Uma cook, chopping big white mushrooms and boning fish. But only when the moon was black. The rest of the time she was an orphan girl in a pair of battered boots too big for her feet and a brown cloak with a ragged hem crying, "Mussels and cockles and clams!" as she wheeled her barrow through the ragman's harbour. The moon would be black tonight, she knew. Last night it had been no more than a sliver. What do you know that you did not know when you left us? the kindly man would ask as soon as he saw her. "I know that Brusco's daughter Breya meets a boy on the roof when her father is asleep," she thought. "Breya lets him touch her," Talia says, "even though he's just a roof rat and all the roof rats are supposed to be thieves." That was only one thing, though. Cat would need two more. She was not concerned. There were always new things to learn down by the ships. When they returned to the house, Cat helped Brusco's sons unload the boat. Brusco and his daughters divided the shellfish amongst three barrows, arranging them on layered beds of seaweed. "Come back when all is sold," Brusco told the girls, just as he did every morning, and they set forth to cry the catch. Breya would wheel her barrow to the Purple Harbor to sell to the Bravosi sailors, whose ships were anchored there. Talia would try the alleys round the moon pool or sell amongst the temples on the Isle of the Gods. Cat headed for the Ragman's Harbor, as she did 9 days of every 10. Only Bravosi were permitted use of the Purple Harbor, from the drowned town and the Sea Lord's palace. Ships from her sister cities and the rest of the wide world had to use the Ragman's Harbor, a poorer, rougher, dirtier port than the Purple. It was noisier as well, as sailors and traders from 50 lands crowded its wharves and alleys, mingling with those who served and preyed on them. Cat liked it best of any place in Bravos. She liked the noise and the strange smells and seeing what ships had come in on the evening tide and what ships had departed. She liked the sailors, too, the boisterous Tairoshi with their booming voices and dyed whiskers, the fair-haired Lysini, always trying to niggle down her prices, the squat, hairy sailors from the port of Ibn, growling curses in low, raspy voices. Her favorites were the summer islanders, with their skin as smooth and dark as teak. They wore feathered cloaks of red and green and yellow, and the tall masts and white sails of their swan ships were magnificent. And sometimes there were Westerosi, too, oarsmen and sailors off Carracks out of Old Town, trading galleys out of Duskendale, King's Landing and Gulltown, big-bellied wine cogs from the Arbor. Cat knew the Bravosi words for mussels and cockles and clams, but along the Ragman's Harbor she cried her wares in the trade tongue, the language of the wharves and docks and sailors' taverns, a coarse jumble of words and phrases from a dozen languages, accompanied by hand signs and gestures, most of them insulting. Those were the ones that Cat liked best. Any man who bothered her was apt to see the fig, or hear himself described as an ass's pizzle or a camel's cunt. "Maybe I never saw a camel," she would tell them, "but I know a camel's cunt when I smell one." Once in a great while, that would make somebody angry, but when it did, she had her finger knife. She kept it very sharp and knew how to use it, too. Red Roggo showed her one afternoon at the Happy Port while he was waiting for Lana to come free. He taught her how to hide it up her sleeve and slip it out when she had need of it, and how to slice a purse so smooth and quick the coins would all be spent before their owner ever missed them. That was good to know, even the kindly man agreed, especially at night when the bravos and roof rats were abroad. Cat had made friends along the wharves, porters and mummers, rope-makers and sail-menders, taverners, brewers and bakers and beggars and whores. They bought clams and cockles from her, told her true tales of Bravos and lies about their lives, and laughed at the way she talked when she tried to speak Bravosi. She never let that trouble her. Instead, she showed them all the fig and told them they were camel cunts, which made them roar with laughter. Galoro Dothar taught her filthy songs, and his brother Galeno told her the best places to catch eels. The mummers off the ship showed her how a hero stands, and taught her speeches from the Song of the Roin, the Conqueror's Two Wives, and the Merchant's Lusty Lady. Quill, the sad-eyed little man who made up all the bawdy farces for the ship, offered to teach her how a woman kisses, but Taganaro smacked him with a codfish and put an end to that. Cosimo the Conjurer instructed her in sleight of hand. He could swallow mice and pull them from his ears. "It's magic," he'd say. "It's not," Cat said. "The mouse was up your sleeve the whole time. I could see it moving." "Oysters, clams, and cockles," were Cat's magic words. And like all good magic words, they could take her almost anywhere. She had boarded ships from Lice and Old Town and the port of Ibn and sold her oysters right on deck. Some days she rolled her barrow past the towers of the mighty to offer baked clams to the guardsmen at their gates. Once she cried her catch on the steps of the Palace of Truth, and when another peddler tried to run her off, she turned his cart over and sent his oysters skittering across the cobbles. Customs officers from the Checky port would buy from her, and paddlers from the drowned town, whose sunken domes and towers poked up from the green waters of the lagoon. One time, when Brea took to her bed with her moonblood, Cat had pushed her barrow to the Purple Harbour to sell crabs and prawns to oarsmen off the Sea Lord's pleasure barge, covered stem to stern with laughing faces. Other days she followed the Sweetwater River to the moon pool. She sold to swaggering bravos in striped satin and to keyholders and justiciars in drab coats of brown and grey. But she always returned to the ragman's harbour. "Oysters, clams, and cockles!" the girl shouted as she pushed her barrow along the wharves. "Mussels, prawns, and cockles!" A dirty orange cat came padding after her, drawn by the sound of her call. Farther on, a second cat appeared, a sad, bedraggled grey thing with a stub tail. Cats liked the smell of cat. Some days she would have a dozen trailing after her before the sun went down. From time to time the girl would throw an oyster at them and watch to see who came away with it. The biggest toms would seldom win, she noticed. Oft as not, the prize went to some smaller, quicker animal, thin and mean and hungry. "Like me," she told herself. Her favourite was a scrawny old tom with a chewed ear who reminded her of a cat that she'd once chased all around the Red Keep. No, that was some other girl, not me. Two of the ships that had been here yesterday were gone, Cat saw, but five new ones had docked. A small carrack called the Brazen Monkey, a huge Ebonese whaler that reeked of tar and blood and whale oil, two battered cogs from Pentos, and a lean green galley up from old Valantis. Cat stopped at the foot of every gangplank to cry her clams and oysters, once in the trade talk, and again in the common tongue of Westeros. A crewman on the whaler cursed at her so loudly that he scared away her cats, and one of the Pentoshi oarsmen asked how much she wanted for the clam between her legs, but she fared better at the other ships. A mate on the green galley wolfed half a dozen oysters, and told her how his captain had been killed by the Lycini pirates who had tried to board them near the Stepstones. "That bastard Sarn it was, with old mother's son and his big Valyrian. We got away, but just." The little Brazen Monkey proved to be from Gulltown, with the Westerosi crew, who were glad to talk to someone in the common tongue. One asked how a girl from King's Landing came to be selling mussels on the docks of Braavos, so she had to tell her tale. "We're here 4 days and 4 long nights," another told her. "Where's a man to go to find a bit of sport?" "The mummers at the ship are doing 7 drunken oarsmen, Cat told them, "and there's eel fights in the spotted cellar down by the gates of Drowned Town, or if you want, you can go by the moon pool, where the bravos duel at night." "Aye, that's good," another sailor said, but what was really wanting was a woman. "The best whores are at the Happy Port, down by where the mummer's ship is moored." She pointed. Some of the dockside whores were vicious, and sailors fresh from the sea never knew which ones. Svron was the worst. Everyone said she had robbed and killed a dozen men, rolling the bodies into the canals to feed the eels. The drunken daughter could be sweet when sober, but not with wine in her, and Kanker Jane was really a man. "Ask for Mary. Marilyn is her true name, but everyone calls her Mary, and she is." Mary bought a dozen oysters every time Cat came by the brothel and shared them with her girls. She had a good heart, everyone agreed. That and the biggest pair of teats in all of Braavos, Mary herself was fond of boasting. Her girls were nice as well, blushing Bethany and the sailor's wife, one-eyed Ina, who could tell your fortune from a drop of blood, pretty little Lana, even Asadora, the Ebonese woman with the moustache. They might not be beautiful, but they were kind to her. "The Happy Port is where all the porters go," Cat assured the men of the Brazen Monkey. "The boys unload the ships," Mary says, "and my girls unload the lads who sail them." "What about them fancy whores the singers sing about?" asked the youngest monkey. a red-haired boy with freckles who could not have been much more than 6 and 10. "Are they as pretty as they say? Where would I get one of them?" His shipmates looked at him and laughed. "Seven owls, boy," said one of them. "Might be the captain could get himself a courtesan, but only if he